Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This is Ryan Fitzpatrick, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Neil Reynolds Podcast, brought to you in association with NFL Game Pass. It's Super Bowl week, the defining week in any NFL season, as the Cincinnati Bengals go head-to-head with the Rams from Los Angeles. This coming Sunday, it's in LA, and as ever, we'll be all over that and covering that. And as ever, we're bringing you the stories that are life-affirming in the NFL. Dante Stallworth was a wide receiver who became a first-round draft pick straight out of college, and he made headlines on the field throughout his career, but he also suffered tragedy off it. His story is one of highs and lows. It's one that promotes the good and bad when it comes to being a pro athlete. But as you'll discover from our conversation, Dante is as humble as they come. And when tragedy struck in his life, he dealt with the consequences head on and learned from the lessons it taught him to become the man he is today. So before we get into his story, remember you can watch this episode in full along with every other episode from season two of the podcast by heading over to nflgamepass.com. And if you're listening on your favorite podcast platform, please leave us a five-star rating and a nice review also. It makes it easier for people to find us. Now, over to my conversation with Dante Stallworth. I'd like to kind of start at the beginning. Obviously, growing up in California, was football a big part of your life? Did you, were you running around as a kid playing football?
I was. I'm from Sacramento, California, so I grew up a huge San Francisco 49ers fan, and I'm 41 right now, so the mid-late 80s and early 90s were the glory years for the 49ers, and I was a teenager, so, you know, a young kid and a teenager, so those were some of the best years of my football life, just to be able to watch guys like Joe Montana, Steve Young, Jerry Rice, Roger Craig, Ronnie Lott, you know, all the Hall of Famers that we've had, and I say we because that was my team, but you know, they were a great lot. They were, you know, great guys on and off the field. And it was just a joy to be able to watch them. And my dream was hopefully one day I could be playing in the NFL like those guys were.
Yeah. So, I mean, obvious question, Jerry Rice must have been one of your heroes.
He was, you know, he was a hard worker. He was a great wide receiver. I remember just watching him and just really remembering that he rarely dropped any passes. I could probably remember maybe one or two passes a year that he dropped. Mm. And I just remember, I you know, as I got into the NFL later on down the line, I remember I dropped like four passes in one game. And I was like, this is not very Jerry Rice-like, Dante. What are you doing?
I'm glad you mentioned his work ethic. I think over the years, I've always championed Jerry Rice as the greatest receiver of all time. And I actually pointed to the work ethic, and he would run the hills of San Francisco, and he would always put in that off-season grind. I think I kind of bored everyone to death with that, but it is a part of it, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of work, even, and we're recording this in Super Bowl week. Joe Burrow spoke this week and said, you know, don't post every workout on Instagram, work in silence. Actually, working in silence is what you need to do, isn't it, to reach the top of the NFL?
Yeah, I think there's especially in today's world, today's society, where everyone wants to post everything. I think if you focus more on your workouts, and I think that's what he was trying to say. I know a lot of guys like to post their workouts, and that's okay. I don't have a problem with it, but I think at the same time too, it almost becomes just this kind of a show instead of actually burrowing down and really getting the work in. And that's what Jerry did. Jerry, you know, we didn't have social media back in those days, but you know, Jerry was a worker, and he along other guys with him on the team to run those hills, and they just couldn't believe how, you know, once they got to the end, that he would just take off and explode, and they thought that it was the end of the run, and he would go and, you know, go for another run, and they just couldn't believe it. But it manifested itself very well in the games, at the end of the games, in the fourth quarter, in the 2 minutes when the team really needed him and needed him to come up with the big play at the end when everyone else was tired. He was still going full speed.
So you were a high school track star. So assume you played receiver in high school and then you went on to Tennessee. So is that, was it always wide receiver for you?
I grew up a big Jerry Rice fan, but I was also a fan of Deion Sanders as well. I actually like defense much better. I like to hit guys. I like to be physical. And I tried, once I made the decision to play wide receiver in college, and I'll be honest, I don't know how many times I've divulged this information, not that it's a secret, but I just remember coming out of high school thinking I didn't want to cover guys like Randy Moss and Jerry Rice. So I was like, you know, I'm pretty fast, so I can run by a lot of guys. And I was like, I'll just stick with that and play wide receiver. But I loved playing defense growing up, though. I loved it.
It's interesting you told yourself off for dropping three or four passes, because didn't you get the nickname Hands when you were at Tennessee?
It was in college we had a really good team. Peyton Manning really put Tennessee on the map. Tennessee had been playing well, but before Peyton got there, but when Peyton Manning got there and brought all the Heisman hype and all that to the college, then that's really when it started to go like nationwide. And I remember thinking to myself before I got to Tennessee, just thinking, God, that orange is awfully ugly. But once I got there, it grew on me and I love it. And I'm actually wearing a Rocky Top shirt now. So
yeah, you don't mind it now. Absolutely.
No, I love it.
What was it like as a young, it's one of the things, I guess, in British sport, we don't have huge high school football like they have in Texas. And sometimes I'll talk to people about college football. You know, you're 18, 19 years old, running out of that tunnel in front of what, 103,000, 101,000 in Tennessee?
Yeah.
What's that like?
It was amazing. It just seeing that huge stadium before I even committed to the University of Tennessee, and just realizing, you know, those big games that they've had against Florida and Alabama and LSU and Notre Dame. I don't want to say it was intimidating, but I would say it was kind of fulfilling, because I knew that coming out of high school, being from California, and football is, like you mentioned, Texas, football isn't as big as it is in California as it is in Texas and some of the more southern states in the United States. But I knew that I wanted to go somewhere where they were extremely passionate about football. And that turned out to be the SEC and Tennessee. They're as big as football fans as you'll get in the country.
What was it like being a first round draft pick? So 2002, you go to the New Orleans Saints. Did you feel any pressure with that? Or was it all kind of positives? Or is there something that kind of weighs on you when you are a first round pick? Because by the time you hear your name called, I mean, you've been discussed every which way but sideways. Yeah. I mean,
yeah, it was fun. I think more so than anything, it was a childhood dream come true. And I realized the blessing that was, because not many of us, unfortunately, in this lifetime or in our lifetimes get to live our childhood dreams. You know, we all have dreams of wanting to be or do something as a child. And for a number of reasons, whatever, unfortunately, they just don't manifest in that way. And I felt like I had worked hard to get to where I was. So I didn't really feel any pressure. I was very confident in what I could do. I just wanted to get to work. I just wanted to be a part of the team. And when I got there, speaking of drop passes, I think my first two or three practices, I dropped maybe 10 passes. And I was just thinking to myself, oh my God, am I over my head here? Because I left school a year early. I chose to forego my senior year at the University of Tennessee. So, I was, for a split second, I was thinking, am I in over my head? And then, I just, started to catch the balls and they started to become more easier and more confident. And I thought about that too, when Jamar Chase, the wide receiver from the Cincinnati Bengals, was having some issues early on. And I just remember telling everybody, he's going to be fine. He's going to be fine. He's all right. He'll be okay. He'll get adjusted and it'll happen. He's a natural pass catcher. And, not to veer too far off topic, but I love watching that kid play. He's a great player. And I'm looking forward to him this Sunday.
I am going to ask you about the Super Bowl wide receivers in a minute, because I do want to get your take on the Super Bowl, which is coming up as we're recording this. Let's be fair. It wasn't all drop passes. More than 300 catches, You had that successful stint with the Saints. Then you was in Philadelphia, New England, Cleveland. So 1 year each time there. What happened there before? And we'll get to kind of 2009 in a second. But what happened there, do you think, with moving from team to team? And what's that like as well for you, your family? Because there's a human side to every transaction, isn't there?
Right. Yeah, it is. It is. And I think a lot of people, maybe more so back in my playing days, more so than it is today. But the human element was really not a big part of it. And I think a lot of that has to do with the media, the social media, not being able to see guys literally uproot their families and move from city to city when they're going to different teams. But I would say after New Orleans, I was traded to the Philadelphia Eagles on the last year of my contract. Sean Payton had come in and he essentially wanted to clean house. He wanted to make sure that he had all his guys in. And it was funny because he and I started off on really good terms. And then we went to rocky terms. And then when I was traded away to the Eagles, we played each other in the second round of the playoffs that year. And they beat us by a field goal at the end of the game. And I was just despondent on the sidelines, on our own sidelines after the game. And he came all the way over and kind of patted me on my head and said, you know, you had a good season and looking forward to watching you play well next year. And then I saw him at the Super Bowl that year. And then we just kind of hashed everything out. And, you know, we just realized that we were just two grown men who were very, extremely competitive. And we hashed it out and we became actually pretty good friends after that. But then after the Eagles, I was unrestricted free agent. My contract was up. So I was looking to sign with the new team. I wanted to stay in Philly, but I know they wanted me to sign a 1 year deal at that time. And let's see what happened. Oh, and unfortunately, Donovan McNabb, our quarterback at the time, had torn his ACL mid season. So he was coming off of a very tough injury, and it was his plant leg for a quarterback. It's the arm that you throw with. It's that leg, his right leg, because he's a right armed quarterback. Yeah. And so, and I knew that I was going to be on a 1 year contract because I had gotten hurt that year and missed 4 or 5 games. So teams wanted to see if I was durable enough to play a full season. So that's why the 1 year deal popped up. But then New England came in the picture and wanted me to sign a similar deal. And, you know, and they had Tom Brady at the time, who was extremely healthy and obviously future Hall of Famer. And so I figured if I'm going to stake my career or my next contract on one player, it's going to be Tom Brady. Right. And for me, that was a no-brainer. As much as I loved Philly and the Eagles and being in Philadelphia and the city and playing for that organization and playing for Coach Andy Reid, I really wanted to play with Tom Brady as well. And I went there and had a pretty good year. We had a pretty good year as a team. That was a rough year, but, you know, that season really, to be able to play with so many future Hall of Famers, to be able to witness greatness, to witness guys who were literally masters at their craft. It was eye opening because I was a little immature at that time going into, leaving Philadelphia, going into New England. I needed to kind of be put through a maturation process and that helped a lot. As far as becoming a professional and understanding what it meant fully to be a professional in the NFL.
We'll be back with more from Dante on the Neil Reynolds podcast after this short break.
This is Jack Crawford, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds podcast.
Hey, Neil. Gary here.
Gary Hayes. How are you, mate?
The end is nigh, mate. Are you happy that I'm just looking at you on the Zoom when we were doing the stuff with Dante? I feel like you need a rest. You could, you know, after the Super Bowl, I think you need to go somewhere like Paris just to recover.
Don't tell everyone where I'm going. Don't tell everyone where I'm going. or will I? Or will I go somewhere else? You'll never know. I get to this stage of the season and you're just so excited that the Super Bowl's here, but you're also knackered. And it's just like get across the finish line. But you get that adrenaline rush on Super Bowl week. Is fantastic. And then kind of hits me halfway through the second half of the Super Bowl that it's all about to come to an end. And then it kind of screeches to a halt and you wake up on Monday morning / afternoon and you just think, well, that's that. That's the season. And especially this year, it's been such an amazing season. Who'd have thought we'd have the Bengals and the Rams here? We certainly didn't think we'd have the Bengals going into the season. Only Jacksonville, Houston, and the New York Jets had longer Super Bowl odds than the Cincinnati Bengals. They only won four games last year. But here they are. So, yeah, it's coming to the end, but it's been a special, special season.
Well, I do have some Super Bowl-related questions for the mailbag at the end, but as we're talking Game Pass here, where I'm going to be watching it on Sunday, who are your favourites for the Super Bowl, and why do you think whoever it is you're going to predict to win it will win it?
So I think it's the Rams, but only just. I think it'll be a close game. These teams are pretty identical in their records, points scored in the regular season. Both had to come from behind to win in the conference championships. But I think there's a bit more firepower on the Rams, only just. I mean, Jamar Chase and Joe Burrow are outstanding. I think it comes down to this, Gary. The Bengals do not protect Joe Burrow very well. And the Rams have the best defensive player we've seen in the NFL in a generation in Aaron Donald. So I think Aaron Donald can take over this game. Last year, Patrick Mahomes had his Super Bowl destroyed by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers pass rush. I think that the pressure is going to be on Joe Burrow physically. I think he can handle the mental pressure. Aaron Donald's going to be coming after him, Von Miller, Leonard Floyd. And I think he copes with it for the most part, because I do think it'll be a close game, but I think that'll be the difference. That and the fact the Bengals kicked a lot of field goals in the playoffs, four field goals in every game. They need to turn some of those field goals into touchdowns.
So this is the part of the show that we're talking about Game Pass. So the one thing I wanted to ask you about as well is because one of the features on Game Pass is the highlights and everything else, but I've loved watching the halftime shows from previous years because they had Lady Gaga, they had J-Lo, and so I was watching them. So how are you feeling about this year's halftime show with Dr. Dre?
And Friends, right?
And Friends.
Great, apparently. I don't know.
Not your scene?
No, not my bag. None of the halftimes are. None of them. It's normally the time I get, the only chance I get to go to the toilet when I'm in the stadium. I quite enjoy Coldplay.
I was going to say, the best one has been Bruce Springsteen, and what he did
Bruce
was...
Bruce Springsteen was great.
And he changed the lyrics to Glory Days, where he was talking about a guy being a baseball player, but he changed it to an American footballer, and he said he'll throw that Hail Mary past you.
If you ever see the Sky copy of that, that was a Super Bowl I was doing for Sky, and Bruce Springsteen slides across the stage at one point and almost lands on one of the speakers. And when we go back to the Sky studios, I said, Bruce Springsteen's lucky he didn't end up singing like the Bee Gees. Boom boom, I'm here all week, and
annoyingly the Bruce Springsteen highlights haven't been on Game Pass, but if you do want to watch the other highlights, then just head over to nflgamepass.com, where you can get all of the action for this weekend in the Super Bowl, and it comes at the price of 99p. So with that in mind, Neil, and everyone spending their 99p wisely this week, I'll let you get back to Dante.
Hi, I'm Bruce Arians, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
So you played New Orleans, Philadelphia, Cleveland. And obviously New England, but I'm just thinking Philly and Cleveland, those fans, they'll tell you about it when you're doing well, but they'll also let you know when you're not, right? I mean, there's no gray area there.
No, it isn't. And people always ask me, I was at a restaurant. I live in Washington, D.C., and I was in a restaurant a couple weeks ago. And bumped into a couple of Eagles fans, and they were telling me how much they enjoyed that season, that 2006 season. And they always ask me like, what do I think about the Philly fans? And I said, you know, it's, to me, it's simple. You do well and they're going to praise you. If you don't do well, they won't praise you. They'll still love you like your family members. They're going to see when you're doing wrong and they're not going to hold back, but they still love you. And, you know, it's essentially a blue collar city, a family oriented town. And so they treat you that way. They'll let you know when you're doing well, and they'll definitely let you know when you're not doing so well.
Absolutely. Let's go to the morning, if you don't mind, of March 14th, 2009. Did you become a cautionary tale for other NFL players with the accident that led to DUI manslaughter charges for you? Maybe just tell me the bits you're comfortable sharing with us. About that morning and how that affected you.
Yeah, it was another, you know, typical day where I had it was a Friday morning where I had worked out with a number of other guys in the NFL, where a lot of us work out in South Florida, particularly in Miami. So, you know, we had worked out all day, and then we kind of went to hang by the pool, and I was really tired at the end of the day. So I went home and went to sleep. And then when I woke up, I was waking up by a call about 2 a.m. and a friend of mine was having a birthday get together and asked me if I wanted to join. Well, not necessarily asked me, kind of said, hey, come hang out. You know, it's my birthday. And we were going to, everyone in the NFL was about to start our offseason program that next Monday. So I went out and we had some drinks. And then I ended up going home around 6:45. I get home and I fell asleep for a little bit and I woke up and I had just moved into this place. So I didn't have any food. I didn't know any restaurants that were open around the area. So I decided to drive to the place where I knew that was open, which was, you know, not far, about an 8-minute drive from my place door to door. And as I got into the car and was driving across the causeway, across the highway, there was a man named Mr. Reyes who had run across the highway. And by the time that I was able to, you know, see him, I had unfortunately hit him. And this was right before daybreak. So there were other cars on the highway, and it was for me, you know, I didn't really know exactly how bad that he was hurt, but I knew that I had hit him as he was running across the highway. So I stopped my car, and I was in disbelief, but I was also more of like, let's get him help. And so I called 911 immediately. And, you know, when they got there, I couldn't really tell what was going on because there were, the paramedics and fire trucks on scene. And so I kept asking the officers on the scene, you know, is he okay? Is he okay? And, I didn't get any notification. They wouldn't tell me, but, I did go down to the police station. What we have in America is called Miranda rights, where you have Miranda rights. If you don't want to speak to authorities, you don't have to without an attorney present. But I waived those rights, not mostly because I wanted to just be as helpful as I could. I didn't feel that I had anything to hide, and I wanted to be as helpful as I could to the process. And then I gave my statement, and I was able to go home. But before I gave my statement, the police had notified me that Mr. Reyes had passed away. And that was the worst day of my life. It was the worst day for my family, and obviously for Mr. Reyes's family as well. It was a very bad day for them as well. But moving forward, I think after that, I didn't want to. Once I was able to kind of get my emotions together and kind of, you know, get my bearings and figure out how I would be able to move forward. I didn't know it initially, but I think the family of Mr. Reyes, them reaching out to me through my attorneys and saying that they appreciated how I handled everything after the fact. It even though I was still, you know, obviously broken up about it as much as they were, that started to begin the healing process for me, because it was something that I, you know, I was a guy who I get along with everyone, never been in a fight before, except on the field, but that doesn't count. But, you know, I'd never been in a fight. I get along with everyone. And for me to be a part of something like that, it's very, very hurtful. And so I knew that, once the healing process began, I knew that I needed to, as difficult as it was for me to relive the story every time I tell it, and to have you know, all these emotions running through my mind and through my body again, I knew that the most important thing was to get the message out, not only to other, you know, athletes, NFL players, but to people in general, to really become that cautionary tale, as you said. It was something that I immediately was able to do with the NFL and working with Mothers Against Drunk Driving, going to speak to colleges about social responsibility, speaking to other teams, speaking to other professional leagues and players about social responsibility and the dangers of drinking and driving. And, you know, I think the biggest message that I tried to pull from that was to have a plan before you go out. Because if you leave it up to your own devices, if you leave it up to your own, if under your own volition, then you're just operating off of the present tense, off of the current time. But if you have a plan prior, then you know, hey, if I'm going to have some drinks, I'm going to have a car service. I'm not going to drink. Right. I'm not going to drive to this place and then make a decision to not drink or to drink. By then it's too late. You have to plan ahead. And I know a lot of players that have reached out to me personally, and even kids in college who have had some issues with DUIs or any other issues that they've reached out, didn't really feel comfortable speaking to me about it when I was there at their college or there at their team. But I appreciate that they feel they can reach out to me, because that's what I want to be, that person that they can reach out to, that they feel that I would be non-judgmental to them and understanding and be able to help them move forward in any way that I possibly could.
Absolutely. Obviously you serve some time in prison, community service, you go through all of that, of course. And then you were suspended for a year by the commissioner of the NFL, Roger Goodell. And then obviously their reinstatement comes to get back into football. I just wonder, we hear about players that get suspended or then reinstated. And I wonder how much personal interaction is there in those moments between you and the commissioner? How much does he get involved in talking to you? How much do you stay close afterwards? I don't even know if that is the case, that you're close. I mean, just take us into that. What happens there with the commissioner when you're suspended, then reinstated?
I can't speak for everyone's case, but I believe that the commissioner is involved to some degree in everyone's case. But specifically for me, I know that Roger was instrumental in me getting back into the NFL. He was instrumental in my suspension. I spent some time with him, and we had a long, difficult conversation about a number of things. And he easily could have just said, you know what, we don't want you in this league. We don't want that to be a part of the NFL shield. But he didn't. He wanted to know first, before anything else, that I understood the severity of the situation. He wanted to make sure that I was remorseful about everything, and wanted to know what I was going to do moving forward. And once he was comfortable with all those things, he essentially wrapped his arms around me and helped me get back into the NFL. He and I became extremely close. I can't say enough about what the commissioner has done for me. You know, not only getting back into the league, but you know, putting me in a position to be able to help rookies coming into the NFL, to be able to speak to them, speak to teams, speak to other folks, to really, you know, get my story, get my message across, because we all think that it can't happen to us or that it won't happen to us. Mm. And then we unfortunately act under that accord. But, you know, I am in a position to be able to tell people that, no, it can't happen to you. It happened to me. And if you're not smart about your decisions, then things can snowball and get out of hand before you even realize it. So the commissioner, we still keep in touch. I've been retired for 8 years. We speak a few times a year. Whenever I'm in New York, I go up and, you know, even if it's last minute, he'll take me in his office and we'll have a conversation. And I appreciate everything that he's done, not just for me, but, you know, for being able to put me in positions where I can help others as well. And so he's been instrumental in, like I said, not only getting me back into the league, but helping me afterwards as well.
Yeah, so you finished up with Baltimore, Washington, New England. How hard was it to kind of switch it back on physically? Well, maybe and mentally, because, you know, having had a year out of the game, was it tough, you know, coming to the end of your career?
Yeah, it was, because I was turning, I was closing in on 30, and I knew that that's kind of the age in the NFL where, you know, where you can, where for most people, you can start to feel your talents start to diminish just a little bit. But, you know, for someone who's been, I hate to toot my own horn, but like, we all consider ourselves world-class athletes. So to feel that, you know, you're not as fast as you used to be, you're not as quick as you used to be, it can play on your mind. But I knew that year that I was out, that I was suspended, I knew that I had to work harder than I ever had to stay in shape, not only because I was older, but because I was out for a full season. And, you know, no matter how talented you are, no matter how hard you work, if you miss an entire NFL season, it's going to be difficult to just pick up where you left off. It usually doesn't work like that for most people. But I tried to work as hard as I could. And, you know, physically, I felt like I came back in a position where I was, you know, just as healthy and ready to go as I was. The mental side of it, again, I'd have to credit the commissioner, because they put me in a situation where I could speak to someone professionally. And I did that throughout the season, actually throughout the next couple of seasons. I did that, and it was helpful. And you know, there's this stigma that if you seek professional help, then something's wrong with you, or you know, you're mad or you're insane. And that situation really made me understand that you know, at the end of the day, we all have people we speak to in confidence, right? We all, whether if it's our parents, our siblings, our best friends, our significant others, whoever they are, we always speak to people in confidence when we want some advice, when we're hurting, when we need someone to talk to. And this is the same thing. You know, obviously that trust factor is not there initially, but this person's a professional and that's what they do. That's how they make their living. This is what they do for a living. So it's essentially the same thing. And that's another message that I've been able to kind of latch on to the social responsibility is, hey, don't be afraid to ask for help. Because I didn't realize that how badly that I needed to speak to someone. I didn't realize it at the time until I began to speak to someone regularly, and it was extremely helpful for me.
Yeah, hopefully that's changing. You see a bit more of that where players are reaching out, talking about their mental health. Of course, we had Calvin Ridley step away from the game this year for a while with the Falcons. So you hope that players get their help. It's interesting just looking at your career, Dante, and charting it. And because of your athletic skills, the first part of it was all about catches and yards and touchdowns. Then, I guess, shaped by a tragedy, it became much bigger than that, didn't it? I mean, you think about catches and yards compared to some of the messages you just mentioned there. It's maybe what you tell me. Is that kind of more important to you as you look at your whole career now?
Yeah, I do. I do. I feel like, you know, I just think back to when I was a kid watching these guys play and just making great plays and, you know, jumping around in my living room as a kid, making all the noise that I could. Those were great times. And I've had that where I've had some younger guys in the NFL who were growing up watching me play, like a lot of guys from Louisiana, like Odell Beckham, Jarvis Landry. You know, when I've bumped into some of those guys, they were kids when I was playing in New Orleans and growing up in their backyard, or playing in their backyard when they were growing up. So, you know, all those things are they're good feelings, and it's good to know that you brought people joy in that way. But at the end of the day, I knew that even as a kid, I always wanted to be in a position to help people. I never imagined in a million lifetimes that it would be under these circumstances. But, you know, this was the bed that I made, and I feel that, you know, as difficult as it is sometimes to be able to give this message on a consistent basis, it's where my life is. And it's something that I know that I need to do, because there are many people who need to hear this message. And there are many people who are afraid to talk to others about similar situations, but when they see me speak out about it, then it makes them feel a little more comfortable, if not speaking to me, then speaking to others about something that they feel that they need to do.
Let's finish up. Let's talk about the Super Bowl then. Some of the receivers in this Super Bowl, pretty mouthwatering. When you look at, you just mentioned Odell Beckham, who's really come on as well. You've got Ja'Marr Chase, Cooper Kupp. I mean, tell me what we can look forward to with some of those guys and who you really like out of that group.
Oh, man, I love all those guys as a wide receiver. I've always liked Odell. I liked him at LSU when he was in college. Cooper Kupp, my brother, my younger brother is a huge Rams fan, and he'd been telling me about Cooper Kupp for a while. And I didn't really start to pay much attention to him until the last couple of years. And then obviously this year, no matter who you were, if you were watching any football, you paid attention to him because he was actually the reason why I lost my fantasy Super Bowl Cooper Kupp, because I think he scored like 50 points in one game. But those guys are amazing. They're masters at what they do. They run great routes. They've all got great hands. They're great teammates. You could tell their teammates love them. Their coaches really enjoy them. It's difficult to pick which receiving crew is better, but I know that you know, going into this game, I'm obviously, being a wide receiver, I would love to see all those guys do really well. I want to see a lot of points on the board. I know defensive players don't really like that as much, but it makes the game, I think, more exciting when you have a lot of points scored. And these guys on both sides of the ball for both teams are definitely up for the task.
And last one then. So you mentioned you've enjoyed playing with Tom Brady. You mentioned playing with Donovan McNabb. So let's say we get you back in for one more play, one more game. Do you want to play with Joe Burrow or do you want to play with Matthew Stafford?
Woo!
Tough one.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to break this down as best as I can. I love Joe Burrow. I have his jersey, actually. I wore it last week. Everyone made fun of me. I was on any podcast that I could go on saying that the Bengals were going to win because I had that much faith in Joe Burrow and the team. Matt Stafford, I actually know him a little bit. We used to train together. He would come down to Miami and throw with us. And I'm so happy for him after leaving Detroit, where they haven't had much success. And then he comes to LA and is, you know, in the Super Bowl. That's a tough one. I think only because I've already caught passes from Matt Stafford, even though it hasn't been in an actual game, I think it would have to be Joe Burrow. I have his jersey anyway. He's, you know, he's an LSU guy. I have a thing for Louisiana, not so much LSU because that's my rival at Tennessee, but I would probably say Joe Burrow. He reminds me a lot of a mixture of guys, and you know, he's just a great player, and I'm excited to see how he comes out. I'm excited to see what he wears for the game, first of all.
That's
and
part
then I'm excited
of it, isn't it?
To see how he plays. Yeah, it is. I think so, especially today. You know, it's always fun to watch the guys and to see them come out. It's kind of like the entrance for boxers when you watch a boxing match, right? It's kind of like the entrance for them. And you know, he likes to have a lot of fun with it. He's a young guy, full of energy, and everyone loves him. I don't know anyone who doesn't like Joe Burrow, maybe except for Rams fans now, but you know, it'll be exciting, and I'm excited to see what those guys do. But to answer your question, I would probably have to pick Joe Burrow. I already have his jersey and I'm going to be wearing it on Sunday. So I'm looking forward to him doing well.
Perfect. You said a mixture of guys. I've seen him compared to Joe Montana. I've seen him compared to Tom Brady. Yeah. Is that where you're going? Yeah. Like top of the tree.
Yeah. 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 I think so. And it's, you know, it's hard. I don't like to put that type of pressure on young guys, especially, but he's got that in him. He doesn't get flustered. You could see him in the field. And when I'm watching games with people, I try not to be too annoying, but I like to look at the little things that most people wouldn't know unless you've been in that huddle. And he doesn't get flustered. He's just super cool. And it's really fun to watch how someone that young at the quarterback position can just take charge. And I remember really quick, I remember a story hearing about Joe Montana playing the Bengals I think it was either 88 or 89. I think he played
the
back-to-back season. 88 season.
Yeah.
And so Joe Montana's in the huddle and they're, you know, it's a 2-minute drive, last 2 minutes of the game. They have to score to win the game. And Joe Montana's in the huddle and it's a TV timeout or a timeout. And he says, you know, guys are talking about, you know, like what they're going to do on the next play. And Joe's like, they call him Joe Cool, right? Joe's like, hey, he was like, is that Joe Candy? Is that not Joe Candy? John Candy.
He's like, pointed him out.
Is that John Candy over there? He's like, hey guys, look, And they're looking around and they see him on the sidelines and they're like, dude, what are you talking about? It's the Super Bowl. We got 2 minutes. But that was his way of like, hey, relax. We got this. It's John Candy's over there. We're here. This is a moment. We're gonna enjoy it and we're gonna go down to score. And they did. I believe it was John Taylor who caught the game winning touchdown. So for me, that story I will never forget. And that's the type of thing that I that's the type of vibe that I get from Joe Burrow as well.
So there's my conversation with Dante Stallworth. Let's get to the mailbag then, just to wrap up before we head off and send you off to your Super Bowl parties. Gary, what you got for us?
Hi, mate. Yeah, just picking up on the Super Bowl from the conversation we had earlier. So I've got two questions. They're sort of related as well. The first one is from a chap called The Real Eddie Wilkie. I'm assuming his name is Ed Wilkinson. And he wants to know, Neil, out of all the Super Bowls you've watched and not covered, what is your favorite Super Bowl?
Oh, that's a good question. I really enjoyed Super Bowl 23, the 49ers and Bengals. Joe Montana drove down the field, last drive of the game, 92-yard drive, threw a touchdown to John Taylor with 34 seconds left to break the Cincinnati Bengals' hearts. But my favorite, I was going to say, it was the first one I was hosting for Sky Sports, full-time capacity. Super Bowl 52 out in Minneapolis. Outside, it was minus 29 degrees Celsius. But we were in a dome, thankfully, and it was red hot action. The Philadelphia Eagles beat the Patriots 41-33. But Tom Brady refused to go quietly. He threw for more than 500 yards that night. But Nick Foles caught the Philly special touchdown. They built a statue for it in Philadelphia outside the Eagles stadium. So that was the best one for me as a kind of fan / reporter and presenter.
So the Philly.
That one. And I really like Super Bowl 49 as well. So I was on the sidelines for that one. It was the Patriots that kind of had the number one offense in the NFL against the number one defense, the Seahawks. Seattle had absolutely destroyed Denver the year before in the Super Bowl. They jumped out. They got up to a 14-point lead in the fourth quarter, but Brady brought them back. Then it looked like Russell Wilson was going to steal it, hand the ball to Marshawn Lynch for the touchdown, but no, from the one-yard line, Wilson throws. Malcolm Butler has the interception, and the Patriots somehow win that Super Bowl. I was right there on the goal line reporting and covering that for Sky Sports. Just the most incredible play I've ever seen, the most dramatic ending to any game.
So tell you who else enjoyed that 49ers-Bengals Super Bowl.
Go on.
To anyone who was listening in the episode just now, John Candy,
he would have had a lovely time. I'm sure he had a lovely time. I'm sure he had plenty of popcorn, a few
and
beers,
a hot dog or two.
The thing about that, well, the interesting thing about that was it's one of the famous, the 49ers were so dominant at that time. The Bengals were underdogs again. The throw before the touchdown to win it from Joe Montana, he had a dolly of an interception. He should have been intercepted by Lewis Billups in the end zone. The Bengals should have been Super Bowl champs, and it bounced right off his chest and he dropped it. And the next play, Montana just drills the touchdown and the Bengals are brokenhearted. And they're still looking for their first Super Bowl win this week. They're the one of 12 teams never to have won it. Funny how it works out. They've lost both their Super Bowls to the 49ers. If the NFC Championship game had gone a different way, they'd have been playing the 49ers this weekend again. But is the Rams. So, looking forward to it.
And the last question is from Mandy Reese, who wants to know, Neil, what is it like covering a Super Bowl but not being in the stadium?
Torture. Absolute torture. Major FOMO. Cannot wait for Arizona next year. I'm going to get back out there and it's going to be fantastic. But the important thing is that we get to take the viewer to the stadium and we have great guests on site. We've got Calais Campbell, Warren Moon for us from Sky Sports. But yeah, for the 4 hours or 5 hours I'm on air, I'm dying inside a little bit each time.
And well, I said that was the last question there, but it's a question for me now, setting up next week, because you've actually got the guest sorted.
I have, and he's a two-time Super Bowl champion, and everyone will love him from his coverage on the BBC, and we're not precious on this podcast. We will talk about Sky, we'll talk about Game Pass, we'll talk about the BBC. So next week, I'm going to be joined by the great OC Umenyora, so make sure you tune in for that. My thanks to you, Gary. My thanks to Dante Stallworth. Thank you everyone for listening, and enjoy Super Bowl 56. Listening to the Neil Reynolds podcast. This episode was hosted by myself, Neil Reynolds, while Gary Hayes is our producer. Gary and I have also written this series together. Our consultant producers are Kerry Levy, Nick Lapworth, and Neil Pacchietto. Matt Alabaster is responsible for all of our artwork, including the graphics and videos across our social media channels. Taylor Hayes mixed this episode and also composed our theme music. If you'd like to keep up to date with everything we're doing throughout the season, then please follow us on Twitter and Instagram at the NR Podcast. My personal account is also at Neil Reynolds NFL. If you've enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear more like it, then visit highway61.media. That's HWY61.media. Please tell your friends about the podcast, help spread the word. Better still, leave us a rating and a review wherever you're listening. This has been another Highway 61 production for the Reynolds Podcast Network.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Get started on your painting project this summer and save big money at Menards. Rust-Oleum Stops Rust 5-in-1 Spray Paint lets you choose from 5 unique spray patterns with a twist of the dial, so you can get a professional, corrosion-resistant finish on every project. Save big money on Rust-Oleum Spray Paint now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money.